From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And after a break to cast some votes in the House Intelligence Committee is now back in session, and now it's the Republicans' turn to begin questioning today's two witnesses in the ongoing House impeachment inquiry. In opening statements this morning, Foreign Service Officer David Holmes described that phone conversation he overheard between President Trump and Trump's EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland about investigations Sondland told Trump the Ukrainian president was going to do for him. Afterwards, Holmes says Sondland told him those investigations were into big stuff, Trump's political rival Joe Biden and his son. And former National Security Council official Fiona Hill said that some Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee are pushing false conspiracy theories about Ukraine interfering in the 2016 elections, theories she said are pushed by Russians who actually did the hacking. For those unable to listen, let's get a recap now from Michelle Kellerman, NPR's diplomatic correspondent. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Robin.
And we just want to point out that President Trump tweeted out after David Holmes' testimony today about overhearing Trump's phone call with Sondland, and the president says that's impossible to do, which, of course, has driven everyone to try to demonstrate it. We saw Chris Cuomo on CNN call his mother to prove that you could overhear cell phone conversations. But let's listen to what Holmes said in his opening statement. He went into great detail about that call, about what Sondland and Trump said about what they wanted the Ukrainian president to do for them.
Ambassador Sondland replied, yes, he was in Ukraine, and went on to state that President Zelensky, quote, loves your ass. I then heard President Trump ask, so he's going to do the investigation. Ambassador Sondland replied that he's going to do it, adding that President Zelensky will do anything you ask him to do.
Michelle, we know others have said that this happened, but what was it like to hear Holmes describe this phone call?
Well, I think it's an important moment because, you know, up to now, one of the big Republican complaints has been all of these people. It's hearsay. They didn't hear these things directly from the president. And here was David Holmes, who was overheard the president say this. And also remember, this was the day after Trump had his phone call with Ukraine's new president, Volodymyr Zelensky, in which he asked him this favor, which was the investigation into the Bidens and an investigation into the 2016 election.
Yeah. And by the way, Holmes also accounted, I mean, he left no detail out. And he went on to say that on that phone call, the president and Sondland went on to talk about ASAP Rocky. This is the rapper who was charged with assault in Sweden. Kim Kardashian apparently had appealed to the president to get the charges, you know, dropped. And Sondland, you know, apparently wasn't working. And Sondland tells Trump, according to Holmes, that he should have pled guilty, should have gone to jail. You, he said to President Trump, could have played the racism card.
Well, I think this tells you a lot about how Trump operates, right? I mean, he obviously likes to talk to Gordon Sondland. They speak in this language. Sondland, by the way, yesterday testified he doesn't really remember all the details of this call as much as David Holmes did. But, you know, to him, he said, well, that's definitely how I talk. And, you know, by the way, Trump sent his hostage envoy to help negotiate an end to that ASAP Rocky, that situation. That hostage envoy, Robert O'Brien, is now his national security advisor.
Well, it just, you know, some might say this is further evidence of the inappropriate use of, you know, people who are working for the president. And again, to finish Sondland's thought, Sondland, according to Holmes, said you could have played the racism card, meaning, well, say this just happening because he's black, and then give him a ticker tape parade when he gets home, tell the Kardashians you're sorry. Incredibly cynical exchange. But it's a reminder too, Michelle, that this is all on cell phones in public in a restaurant.
Yeah, and David Holmes was saying, you know, the reason why he remembered it, he's normally a very serious note taker, but wasn't at this situation because it was just a lunch at an outdoor restaurant in Kyiv. But he said it was nothing like I had seen before as a Foreign Service officer, all this colorful language.
Yeah. I talk about the discussion of foreign aid because we remember yesterday when Sondland testified, he was really, you know, strongly questioned by Republicans about the aid. Sondland said he heard firsthand about a trade of a White House meeting and phone call for investigations, but he didn't hear directly President Trump say, I'm going to stop the aid if I don't get an investigation. Holmes described being shocked to learn on July 18th about a hold that was put on U.S. military aid and that President Trump had ordered it, but Holmes wasn't sure why. One month later, this is what he came to think about the aid.
My clear impression was that the security assistance hold was likely intended by the president either as an expression of dissatisfaction with the Ukrainians, who had not yet agreed to the Burisma-Biden investigation, or as an effort to increase the pressure on them to do so.
Yeah, but Michelle, again, this is his impression. Yesterday, words like assumption were used. Nobody has yet said the president said withhold the aid.
Right. But the problem with that line of questioning is that the EU ambassador Sondland was telling Ukrainians that this was the case, and also that they understood clearly earlier that the idea of investigations was clearly tied to a White House meeting. And that was something that Holmes could talk about a lot because Holmes is based in Kyiv. He saw this new government coming to power. I mean, remember, Zelensky is a comedian. He's not a politician. He's a newbie. And he really needs that White House meeting. And that was a clear quid pro quo, as mm-hmm. Sondland said, that if you get this White House meeting, you need to announce these investigations.
And by the way, yesterday we heard a Democrat, Jim Himes, refer to a law that he said prohibits the withholding of aid without congressional approval. This is a 1974 law. What role is that going to play?
Well, I mean, one of the things we haven't heard a lot about is this the role of the OMB, Mick Mulvaney, who's also the acting chief of staff of President Trump. All of these people weren't clear why the aid was held up. All they knew, all that they were told, was that the president ordered OMB to place this hold.
Yeah. What else did you hear today that jumped out at you?
Well, you know, it was interesting to hear from Holmes because he was such a careful note taker. He was there during all of this time. He describes kind of the continuum where, you know, there was this barrage of allegations against Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, like he's never seen before. Those were allegations, you know, led by Rudy Giuliani, Trump's private lawyer. And so these people were concerned already when she was pulled out of the picture. And then to see Giuliani play this key role in Ukraine, he describes some meetings that Giuliani had with Zelensky's, some people who are close to Zelensky, meetings that they weren't really in on.
Let's talk about Fiona Hill, the former Russia advisor, well-known scholar on Russia. She came with a stern warning for Republicans to not peddle this, what she called a false narrative that Ukraine, not Russia, interfered in the 2016 presidential election. And she was asked about this by the Democrats' lawyer, Daniel Goldman.
Why are the Russians pushing that narrative that it was Ukraine? How does that serve Russian interests?
The Russians' interests, frankly, are to delegitimize our entire presidency. So one issue that I do want to raise, and I think that this would resonate with our colleagues on the committee from the Republican Party, is that the goal of the Russians was really to put whoever became the president by trying to tip their hands on one side of the scale under a cloud.
Well, of course, this opens up the Republicans' ability to talk to her about Russia. But remind us, you know, to bring Russia more into this conversation. But remind, and by that I mean the Russia investigation of right. the election in 2016. But remind us, who is Fiona Hill?
So she's a longtime Russia expert, born in England, as you can hear from her accent. She became an American citizen only in 2002. She came to the U.S. initially to study, and she was a Russian scholar, has been interested in this since the 1980s. She served briefly in government before as the national intelligence officer in charge of Russia. They bring in analysts to be in this position. That was end of Bush administration, beginning Obama administration. And she was brought in to this administration to the surprise of many because she's been a strong critic of Vladimir Putin.
Yeah. Michelle Kellerman, you've been, as everyone has been, in the painful position of being glued to these hearings for days. But you are, you know, a diplomatic correspondent. And I'm just wondering, what's going on in Washington? I mean, what are you hearing, a reaction to what's happening?
Well, at least for the State Department, there's this hashtag FS Proud, Foreign Service Proud, that's been going around because you are seeing, you know, the people who are testifying are coming under subpoena, they're forced to testify, and you're seeing these Foreign Service officers who took very careful notes and who reported through their chains of command, as they were supposed to, raise their concerns, didn't come out publicly necessarily, though they may have spoken to the whistleblower. We still don't know anything about that. But you're seeing them lay out this very clear case of what they saw, what they knew. What you're not seeing testify, other than Gordon Sondland, who's a political appointee, you're not seeing a lot of the other big players that the Democrats want.
Yeah, they are abiding by the president's mandate that they not show up. Michelle Kellerman, NPR diplomatic correspondent, giving us kind of a roundup of the hearings today and some other thoughts, which we so appreciate. Michelle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
You may have noticed at last night's Democratic presidential debate in Atlanta that many of the frontrunners were talking directly to Black voters and the need to connect with Black Americans in the race to win the Democratic nomination. This was a definite distinction from previous debates. And some of the most memorable and at times perplexing moments of the night were squabbles with candidates going back and forth over who connects with Black Americans the most. To unpack what happened last night and the significance of it, we're joined by The Washington Post's political reporter Eugene Scott and political strategist and commentator Angela Rye in studio. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay. Yes. So before we begin, we have to talk about where this debate took place, the Tyler Perry Studios in Atlanta. Perhaps a sign of the political and economic power of Georgia, and also really an acknowledgement of the space that Black voters occupy in the primary electorate. But Eugene, I want to start with you first. Talk about the significance of Georgia in the 2020 election.
Well, you can't talk about Georgia and 2020 without talking about Georgia and 2018 and the much larger issue of voter disenfranchisement. And that topic came up repeatedly during the debate, specifically related to Stacey Abrams, who was the Democratic nominee for governor in 2018. And there's genuine concern moving forward that Black voters and Latino voters and perhaps other voters of color will not have their ballots counted as we move into 2020, because many of the problems that existed 2 years ago, should we say, that led to votes being ignored or not counted properly still exists. And so we certainly saw candidates trying to take the lead in addressing that issue, shedding light on it, and perhaps providing solutions to it.
Yeah, a lot of them talked about voter suppression and ways that they were working to fight with it, fight against it. Right from the start, the candidates were speaking, though, to Black voters about a number of issues. In Cory Booker's opening statement, he talked about being at a Black church and his parents attending HBCUs. And when it came to a head that Senator Kamala Harris was asked by the moderator to respond to her previous critique of South Bend, Indiana Mayor Peter Buttigieg, this is what she had to say. Take a listen.
There are plenty of people who applauded Black women for the success of the 2018 election, applauded Black women for the election of a senator from Alabama. But, you know, at some point, folks get tired of just saying, oh, you know, thank me for showing up, and want to, and say, well, show up for me. Because when Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in connection with childbirth in America, when the sons of Black women will die because of gun violence more than any other cause of death, when Black women make 61 cents on the dollar as compared to all women who tragically make 80 cents on the dollar, the question has to be, where you been and what are you going to do? And do you understand who the people are?
I'm going to get to Buttigieg's response in a moment. But Angela, this was a powerful moment.
Mm-hmm. It was, because this is one of those moments where you realize, for those among us who do not realize it, the importance of having a diverse candidacy, a diverse group of candidates speaking to issues. I know that for me, every debate up until last night, the person who has been the voice of reason on police brutality, on gun violence in communities of color, on issues around mass incarceration and criminal justice reform has been Julian Castro, and he was noticeably absent yesterday.
He wasn't there.
And I feel like this particular moment, Kamala Harris really filled that very obvious gap for us.
Yeah, and Julian Castro wasn't there because he didn't qualify.
Right, and based on the standards that they set forth that I think, again, have to be revisited, because in trying to be fair, it still favors folks who can pay their way onto a debate stage, which we saw yesterday as well. And so I think, to the point, Kamala Harris having this moment where she 100% acknowledged, and I'm not saying she ever shies away from her blackness, but really embodied it for the black women who don't have the numbers to be on that stage, who don't have the political experience to be on the stage, but have a common shared experience with her in what it's like to be disenfranchised, discounted, treated as invisible, and feel like they're voiceless with a party that they overwhelmingly support, I thought was powerful.
Yeah, let's go to what Mayor Pete Buttigieg said in response to Harris.
And I care about this because while I do not have the experience of ever having been discriminated against because of the color of my skin, I do have the experience of sometimes feeling like a stranger in my own country, turning on the news and seeing my own rights come up for debate, and seeing my rights expanded by a coalition of people like me and people not at all like me, working side by side, shoulder to shoulder, making it possible for me to be standing here wearing this wedding ring in a way that couldn't have happened two elections ago, lets me know just how deep my obligation is to help those whose rights are on the line every day, even if they are nothing like me in their experience.
Eugene, I want to know from you, hearing that, do you think that Buttigieg made any inroads? I mean, he is really polling very low in South Carolina right now, really at 0%.
You know, he probably did not. I think the point he was trying to make in that moment was, as a member of a marginalized group, as a gay American, he knows what it is like to be otherized and disrespected because of his identity. But bringing it up in a moment when the conversation was about how black people have been historically disenfranchised from the political process came off as tone deaf to quite a few people who are, in fact, both black and gay. And Kamala Harris spoke to that issue this morning at the Black Women's Power Breakfast in Atlanta. She called his comments naive and unproductive. There has
and
to
not
be
direct
a
w- enough. Do you think that was the issue? It just wasn't direct enough. Mm.
It wasn't. He really should have kept the conversation on how black people and black women in particular specifically are harmed by the current political process, opposed to widening it to include how white gay men are as well.
Okay. You know, yeah. Angela, please.
One thing that I think is interesting is you kind of had two tone deafish moments like that last night. The other one came from Joe Biden when Joe Biden said, I'm from the black community. And it's like, Joe, we love you as a, you know, and as a former associate member of the Congressional Black Caucus, sir, we applaud your allyship. But one place you do not come from is out of the black community.
Let's hear that for a moment. He did. It was almost a memeable moment that when he said that. Let's take that clip.
I'm part of that Obama coalition. I come out of the black community in terms of my support. If you notice, I have more people supporting me in the black community that have announced for me because they know me. They know who I am. Three former chairs of the Black Caucus, the only African-American woman that ever been elected to the United States Senate, a whole range of people.
No,
my point
that's
is
not true. The
that's
other
not
one is
true.
Here.
I said the first. I said the first African-American elected. First African-American. So my point is that one of the reasons I was picked to be vice president was because of my relationship, long-standing relationship with the black community. I was part of that coalition.
And Biden was referring to Senator Kara Mosley Braun.
Right.
And he misspoke. He meant to say the first, but he said the only.
And he swore and, he said the first, too. You
hear? Yeah, Kamala Harris was right there next to him. We're laughing at this, but let's talk a little bit about the significance of this. Biden has had a lot of support from Black communities, and I use plural because we are not a monolith.
Yeah.
But sometimes as high as 40% in South Carolina. Do you think this moment, this back and forth with all of them, will have any impact on his standing and the other standings? Angela.
So first, I have to just acknowledge the fact that, no, we're not monolithic, but in so many ways, the Black electorate is parallel to the majority in that they are making decisions about who they think is electable based on what conventional wisdom has told them election after election. This is the same group of people that weren't giving Barack Obama a chance, right? They thought that he was not electable. They said, I remember older Black folks saying we can't get a Black president. We can't have a Black president in the United States. Come on. And so one in the same, Joe Biden has earned some stripes based on the fact, right, that he was a part of the Obama coalition by being the vice president. Mm-hmm. So he gets some gravitas from that maybe he ordinarily wouldn't have. So I think, this is a longer conversation for another day.
Yeah, but it's an important one. Yes. And the important one, Eugene, with the little bit of time we have, I want you to respond to that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think what was also interesting in terms of being tone deaf by Biden's comments is him implying that he was brought on the Obama ticket to help bring more Black votes to the table.
Mm.
And that's actually not why he was brought on. He had foreign policy experience.
Right.
He could really connect with white working class Americans from, you know, places like Scranton, Pennsylvania, where he is from, not the Black community. And that's a good thing. That's a great thing. But to misrepresent the value you bring to the table in front of two other Black candidates who have long roots in the Black community, I don't think won him more points with Black Americans.
Very interesting night and so much more to come. Thank you. That's Washington Post political reporter Eugene Scott and political strategist and commentator Angela Rye.
This week on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR, we take you back to 2015 when Asma Jama, a Somali-American woman, was assaulted for speaking Swahili at a restaurant. Tune in to hear how Asma found support from an unlikely source, the sister of the woman who attacked her.
According to a Pew survey out this year, 71% of Americans think their local news outlets are doing well financially. But nothing could be further from the truth. A report this week from the freedom of speech nonprofit PEN America found that since 2004, nearly 2,000 local outlets have closed, and there are now 200 counties with no local news organization at all. One city council member in Denver says the lack of local coverage makes him feel like he and his colleagues could all be getting away with murder right now. Of course, he meant the metaphorical kind. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
Well, I'm not feeling good about these stats. And if that's not enough, what we just heard, some are calling this week in particular the week we will look back on when we write the history of the newspaper industry's collapse. Remind us why.
There's so much capitulation-driven deal-making. See if you can keep up with this. You have Gatehouse acquiring USA Today parent Gannett, which not too long ago was thought immune to most of the downturn forces. It shooed away a hedge fund. But in this case, private equity ownership is involved. But that same hedge fund, Alden Global, just acquired a 25% chunk of Tribune Publishing, which itself is rumored to be in talks to partner with fellow struggler McClatchy, which owns the Miami Herald. McClatchy is now a penny stock looking at a potential bankruptcy.
Yeah. So to those who are saying, oh, great, you have people with a lot of money coming in to rescue these newspaper organizations, you say what?
There's just been no evidence that private equity or hedge funds, financial sponsors, could pull it off. The idea, in theory, is to consolidate. While capital is cheap, you can share staff across different mastheads, slash payrolls, and then dress up the results as acquisition bait. And all along, you're extracting dividends. Five chains become three, then they're going to spin off assets. Financial players, they've always had a hand in declining industries. It's a super open question if you look at the past 10 years of retrenchment that they've been able to turn anything around.
Yeah. So is it safe to say we'll see more newspaper closures?
I mean, the number of newspaper newsroom employees at newspapers got cut in half between 2008 and 2018. Yeah. We're talking from 71,000 to 38,000. And this has been happening for the better part of two decades across booms and busts. I think the problem is you have newsrooms that were built for the heyday of the full page department store and car dealership ads. Now those profit centers, they've vanished with the classifieds, and these same newspapers are begging readers to belatedly pay up to subscribe while they keep slashing the newspaper.
Look, I'm one of those. I can't function without reading a couple of real newspapers in the morning. I mean, there are articles that don't make it online. There are editors who position things so you know their importance. But there's coverage. I mean, I just don't think you're as informed if you don't read your a local paper. But to people who can't get one or who feel it's fine to get their news from Facebook, maybe it is for them. What do you think are some of the other dangers?
I mean, the press has always been that informal check and balance on state and local government. Graft, covering city council meetings, you know, Freedom of Information Act requests. If you look at the one reporter at the Miami Herald who resurrected the Jeffrey Epstein imbroglio and held the Justice Department and prosecutors and really personally resurrected this, that wouldn't have happened without, you know, Julie Brown at the Miami Herald. Mm. And that's a struggling paper. We talked about McClatchy earlier.
Yeah. So there you have it. I mean, there just won't be the kind of coverage, no matter where it is, it won't be if it's not driven by reporters and newspapers. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And now some key moments from today's impeachment inquiry hearings. Fiona Hill, a former National Security Council senior director for Europe and Russia, and David Holmes, an aide to the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine, testifying before the House Intelligence Committee, both offered firsthand accounts of the Trump administration's unorthodox diplomacy with Ukraine that Democrats say provide more evidence bolstering their case that President Trump attempted to pressure Ukraine's president into launching investigations into his political rival and into a baseless claim that Ukraine, not Russia, intervened in the 2016 election. In her opening statement, Hill chastised those Republican members of the committee, fueling what she called those false narratives.
Based on questions and statements I've heard, some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps, somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves. The unfortunate truth is that Russia was the foreign power that systematically attacked our democratic institutions in 2016. This is the public conclusion of our intelligence agencies, confirmed in bipartisan congressional reports. It is beyond dispute, even if some of the underlying details must remain classified. The impact of the successful 2016 Russian campaign remains evident today. Our nation is being torn apart. Truth is questioned. Our highly professional and expert career foreign service is being undermined. U.S. support for Ukraine, which continues to face armed Russian aggression, has been politicized. The Russian government's goal is to weaken our country, to diminish America's global role, and to neutralize a perceived U.S. threat to Russian interests. President Putin and the Russian security services aim to counter U.S. foreign policy objectives in Europe, including in Ukraine, where Moscow wishes to reassert political and economic dominance. I say this not as an alarmist, but as a realist. I do not think long-term conflict with Russia is either desirable or inevitable. I continue to believe that we need to seek ways of stabilizing our relationship with Moscow, even as we counter their efforts to harm us. Right now, Russia's security services and their proxies have geared up to repeat their interference in the 2020 election. We are running out of time to stop them. In the course of this investigation, I would ask that you please not promote politically driven falsehoods that so clearly advance Russian interests.
And David Holmes described the moment when he and his colleagues at the U.S. Embassy in Kiev learned that the White House froze nearly $400 million of military aid to Ukraine and how he came to understand why.
Given the history of U.S. security assistance to Ukraine and the bipartisan recognition of its importance, I was shocked when on July 18th an Office of Management and Budget staff member surprisingly announced the hold on Ukraine security assistance. The announcement came toward the end of a nearly two-hour National Security Council secure video conference call, which I participated in from the embassy conference room. The official said that the order had come from the president and had been conveyed to OMB by Mr. Mulvaney, with no further explanation. This began a week or so of efforts by various agencies to identify the rationale for the freeze, to conduct a review of the assistance, and to reaffirm the unanimous view of the Ukraine policy community of its importance. NSC counterparts confirmed to us that there had been no change in our Ukraine policy, but could not determine the cause of the hold or how to lift it. On July 25th, President Trump made a congratulatory phone call to President Zelensky after his party won a commanding majority in Ukraine's parliamentary election. Contrary to standard procedure, the embassy received no readout of that call, and I was unaware of what was discussed until the transcript was released on September 25th. Upon reading the transcript, I was deeply disappointed to see that the president raised none of what I understood to be our interagency agreed upon foreign policy priorities in Ukraine, and instead raised the Biden-Burisma investigation and referred to the theory about CrowdStrike and its supposed connection to Ukraine in the 2016 election.
CrowdStrike was the company that found that Russia hacked the 2016 election. Conspiracy theorists think Ukraine did it, not true. Holmes also offered his account of the July 26 phone call between President Trump and EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland, which Holmes overheard at a restaurant in Ukraine.
I then took the opportunity to ask Ambassador Sondland for his candid impression of the president's views on Ukraine. In particular, I asked Ambassador Sondland if it was true that the president did not give an expletive about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland agreed that the president did not give an expletive about Ukraine. I asked why not, and Ambassador Sondland stated that the president only cares about big stuff. I noted there was big stuff going on in Ukraine, like a war with Russia. And Ambassador Sondland replied that he meant big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing.
Well, then Committee Chair Adam Schiff asked Holmes whether the Trump administration pressured Ukraine for investigations that could benefit Trump politically.
So you're acknowledging, I think, Mr. Holmes, are you not, that Ukraine very much felt pressured to undertake these investigations, that the president, Rudy Giuliani, and Ambassador Sondland and others were demanding?
Yes, sir. And although the hold on the security assistance may have been lifted, there were still things they wanted that they weren't getting, including a meeting with the president in the Oval Office. Whether the hold, the security assistance hold continued or not, Ukrainians understood that that's something the president wanted, and they still wanted important things from the president. So and I think that continues to this day. I think they're being very careful. They still need us now going forward. In fact, right now, President Zelensky is trying to arrange a summit meeting with President Putin in the coming weeks, to his first face-to-face meeting with him to try to advance the peace process. He needs our support. He needs President Putin to understand that America supports Zelensky at the highest levels. So this doesn't end with the lifting of the security assistance hold. Ukraine still needs us, and as I said, still fighting this war this very day.
Well, the Democrats' lawyer, Daniel Goldman, also pressed Fiona Hill about a July 10th meeting when she says National Security Advisor John Bolton told her that he was not part of whatever drug deal Sondland and Mulvaney are cooking up.
Do you recall what you said?
Yes.
What he said to you, rather?
I do recall, yes. It was part of a conversation about the things that Mr. Giuliani was saying very frequently in public. We saw them often on television making these statements. And I had already brought to Ambassador Bolton's attention the attacks, the smear campaign against Ambassador Yovanovitch, and expressed great regret about how this was unfolding and, in fact, the shameful way in which Ambassador Yovanovitch was being smeared and attacked. And I'd asked if there was anything that we could do about it. And Ambassador Bolton had looked pained, basically indicated with body language that there was nothing which we could do about it. And he then, in the course of that discussion, said that Rudy Giuliani was a hand grenade that was going to blow everyone up.
Did you understand what he meant by that?
I did, actually.
What did he mean?
Well, I think he meant that, obviously, what Mr. Giuliani was saying was pretty explosive in any case. He was frequently on television making quite incendiary remarks about everyone involved in this, and that he was clearly pushing forward issues and ideas that would, probably come back to haunt us. And, in fact, I think that that's where we are today.
Devin Nunes, the committee's ranking Republican, used his opening remarks today to attack the impeachment inquiry itself.
Throughout these bizarre hearings, the Democrats have struggled to make the case that President Trump committed some impeachable offense on his phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky. The offense itself changes depending on the day, ranging from quid pro quo to extortion to bribery to obstruction of justice, then back to quid pro quo. It's clear why the Democrats have been forced onto this carousel of accusations. President Trump had good reason to be wary of Ukrainian election meddling against his campaign and of widespread corruption in that country. President Zelensky, who didn't even know aid to Ukraine had been paused at the time of the call, has repeatedly said there was nothing wrong with the conversation. The aid was resumed without the Ukrainians taking the actions they were supposedly being coerced into doing. Aid to Ukraine under President Trump has been much more robust than it was under President Obama, thanks to the provision of Javelin anti-tank weapons. As numerous witnesses have testified, temporary holds on foreign aid occur fairly frequently for many different reasons. So how do we have an impeachable offense here when there's no actual misdeed and no one even claiming to be a victim?
And we will continue to follow today's hearings throughout the program. Stay tuned here and now.
Podcasts have opened up the world of prison life to the public. In Colorado, people serving time are producing one that tackles the complexity of life behind bars and the purpose of prisons. Colorado Public Radio's Stephanie Wolf reports.
Denise, let's go ahead and check your...
My levels? Yeah, I had peanut butter and jelly sandwich for breakfast. I'm really excited about interviewing Mr. Williams today.
Denise Presson looks over her hosting notes as a producer does a mic check. She says she didn't know much about podcasting before this project.
I've seen it on TV. That's about it. And I was like, oh, okay, so it's something you subscribe to. Other than that, I have no knowledge. I've been in prison for 10 years.
Presson is serving a 42-year sentence for second-degree murder. Today, she's in a vault at a Colorado Department of Corrections center in Denver that used to store medical records. It's now a makeshift studio for the podcast team.
Because there's no windows, because we're in a sort of cement room, literally a vault, the sound is really nice.
That's Ashley Hamilton. She's the executive producer and a co-host. She also founded the University of Denver's Prison Arts Initiative. It runs a variety of art classes in prisons. The podcast is a new venture for the initiative.
We've never done this before, right? We're figuring this out.
Not just how to record and produce a podcast. Here in the prison, there are lots of logistical challenges.
We also live in a society where you and I are used to pulling out our phone to get whatever done that we need to get. You know, we're not working in that structure.
When the team is together, they'll work a 10 to 12 hour stretch. And because it's no small feat to transport everyone, the project is open to inmates from Sterling Correctional Facility and Denver's Women's Correctional Facility. Hamilton was amazed when the Department of Corrections approved bringing incarcerated men and women into the same room for the podcast.
Andrew Draper, co-host of Within and a resident of Sterling Correctional Facility.
Draper is serving a life sentence for first-degree murder and arson. He listens to podcasts and feels the medium has a certain power.
There's an emotion and there's an energy that translates that you don't get through the written word.
Many of the incarcerated people involved in this or chosen for interviews are in prison for crimes like murder, robbery, and assault. Here are some of their voices.
When you think the wrong thought, you do the wrong things.
My word meant absolutely nothing at that point because I was what everyone else had created me to be.
And I'm thinking to myself, Lord, please, just let me keep my mind. Just let me hold on to my mind while I'm here.
They seem keenly aware of the sorrow they've caused and wonder how to manage that with the life they are living in its wake. Co-host Denise Presson.
And I think that's the ability to go accountability, the responsibility and reparation for that, and then to move past that to where I can still live a fulfilling life, whether it's inside or outside of prison.
They also are bringing prison officials into the conversations. They've talked to wardens and staff. And for this taping, they speak with Dean Williams, the head of Colorado's Department of Corrections.
Mr. Williams has entered. I'd love to introduce you.
It's good to see you again.
Williams settles behind the mic. And it's not long before the co-host asks meaty questions.
What is the purpose of prison? And who deserves to be in prison after they've expressed change or they've shown change?
I mean, this is a huge question. And I
Williams tells them straight up, you're here because you screwed up. But prison is a place for them to turn their lives around. Afterward, he says being interviewed rattled him in a way he didn't expect.
Even the people who were not interviewing me, to see them emotional because we're giving voice to something. And what impacted me is that I saw hope in their eyes where maybe hope didn't exist before.
The podcast team is planning 12 episodes on meaty topics for season one.
This, like, question around different types of crimes that have different moral value.
And dying in prison. They recently interviewed inmates on hospice care.
Also gang culture and the role that it plays, not just in prison, but really in society as a whole.
Co-host Denise Presson is well aware that victims and families of victims might listen.
Nothing I do can bring my victim back. That's the absolute truth in that.
She isn't trying to make excuses for what she did.
What I do hope is that the public, the people beyond the walls, can see that we are humans and that we are not just our crime.
That's the very idea inspiring poet William Graham today. He's serving a 72-year sentence. And for every episode, he writes an original poem. Today's is called The Shift. Ashley Hamilton reads it.
We are all born unprepared, calling for help, only to discover life is real for us all, standing tall on the shoulders of change, telling ourselves we can do better. We have to do better. We must.
Sometimes the inmates say working on the podcast is helping them do better, and they hope it will inspire others within the system to do better as well. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Wolfe in Denver.
And this program note, today's testimony in the impeachment hearings has come from President Trump's former Russia advisor, Fiona Hill, and Foreign Service officer, David Holmes. We'll continue to analyze today's developments on this program and this afternoon on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.